Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Lots to discuss, including two stories from the grocery segment. Once again, Ascena Retail can do no right, as now they're in trouble for a recall from Justice Stores. And we have a story regarding delivery of alcohol products from Meijer Stores in Michigan. Our podcast today is brought to you by Warby Parker and WarbyParker.com, which provides vintage-inspired prescription eyeglasses starting at $95. Warby Parker was founded with a rebellious spirit and a lofty objective to offer designer eyewear at a revolutionary price while leading the way for socially conscious businesses. Get a free 5-day home try-on at WarbyParkerTrial.com/focus. That's WarbyParkerTrial.com/focus. 5 pairs, 5 days, 100% free. Well, something that's not free, legal advice. And right now there are two grocers in the United States that needs a lot of that as Lidl responds to Kroger's trademark infringement suit that came a couple of weeks ago. This is basically a punch counter punch here in terms of the legalities. So I'm going to throw it now to Leighton, who is a little bit more of the legal background and knows a little bit more about how this type of thing works than do I.
I had noted on the last Retail Focus that in another life, I would probably be a lawyer. However, in this life, I am probably not smart enough to be one. But you can see here, there is going to be a lot of lawyering and a lot of talking about the claims of a potential settlement in the coming months from the lawsuit between Lidl and Kroger. As you can see, these allegations are coming by way of Kroger as they're looking at the preferred selection as an infringement on their private selection, their in-house private label brand. And in a statement, Lidl said in court papers filed in Virginia, the U.S. District Court on Friday, that Kroger has offered a striking absence of evidence in support of its claims. As we originally noted as the story first broke, supplying evidence is a burden that lies solely on the plaintiff here. And in another statement, you're seeing that Lidl is saying that Kroger is using the lawsuit to try to disrupt the ongoing launch of new emerging competitors that offers consumers high-quality products at far lower prices, and this distracts from the positive reviews garnered by Lidl's launch by painting Lidl as a copycat. So they're really trying to say that this is nothing that has any suggestion of actual trademark infringement, and that Kroger is really just trying to have this lawsuit to draw up a negative attention surrounding Lidl. And this comes as Lidl is trying to expand throughout the eastern half of the United States. In fact, they had just come out recently saying that they're on track to open another 30 stores for the rest of the summer. Again, they want to have over 300 when it's all said and done. But throughout the timeline of Lidl coming into the United States, there was a lot of skepticism, a lot of people wondering if something like this would happen from the bigger companies that already had the presence in the United States. The trademark claim here at the center of the lawsuit, again, is between the private label brands, and Kroger argues that they've been around trying to build up their private selection brand for over 20 years. And we had noted on the last podcast that the logos are pretty much dissimilar in nature, but that may not be the only thing taken into account here, as Kroger will most likely continue to argue that there may be some confusion with ordinary customers, and they may shop at Lidl now more because they associate the two as having the same overall corporation. So you're seeing that in order to prove damages, which actually may be the toughest part, Kroger has stated themselves that it may be impossible to calculate the irreparable damages sought here. But since Lidl has been open now for about 4 weeks, the sales would be very minimal. You're talking about sales losses for only 4 weeks' time, and the locations are not all by a Kroger location either, making the case a little bit more complex, as they would have to gather evidence as it relates to the normal shopping behavior from those in the area versus the proximity of the other local grocery competitors.
We knew Lidl would try to get out in front of this on a PR perspective. And this statement, you know, it's no question why it was picked up by the press, because it was a strong statement. And in fact, the statement includes a phrase that says, and I quote, when in fact Lidl is a decidedly different and better grocery experience, end quote. And of course, from this, you're seeing not only Lidl responding to Kroger's initial statement, but also taking a not so subtle dig at Kroger's existing operations that they've established in the United States. But Leighton, you make a good point in that burden of proof, of course, is required by the plaintiff, and a lot of these studies could necessitate taking place over 6 months or a year. While we've got 4 weeks or so of sales from Lidl to compare to Kroger and say maybe they're swiping some of these sales away due to this private label brand, while the study is progressing, Lidl's not pulling their preferred selection products back, of course. So the damages could compound themselves if indeed the lawsuit is found in favor of Kroger. And again, we don't know Kroger's true intentions here. It could be maybe to sully Lidl in the eyes of the media or the public. It could be to authentically win money from Lidl, a company that's kind of encroaching on their boundaries here in the United States. But again, as Leighton mentioned, not all Kroger locations are near a Lidl. Likewise, not all Lidl locations or expansion targets for Lidl are near a Kroger. So this is going to be difficult to prove out exactly how much damage was done to the Kroger brand awareness for the traditional consumer. Even though most lawsuits like this settle, they don't actually go through the full term of the lawsuit. For both of these companies, it might be better to quickly get this one done. And certainly for Lidl, the settlement, they would want to come in a quick fashion. Leighton mentioned the 30 more stores that they were looking to open by the end of this summer, but they're in the middle of spending a lot of money in the U.S. trying to expand, not only opening up stores, but opening up supply chains. Leighton mentioned during the last podcast when we discussed Lidl that they have a lot of private label products that originate from the U.S., so they've got to open up supply chain and distribution networks there. They're also opening distributorships. All of this is going to tie up money, and what else ties up money is legal issues and legal matters. So the longer this drags out, the more it's going to dent Lidl's pocketbooks. And while Lidl is a very large European company, we should remember that, again, Kroger, in terms of their domestic holdings, they have more grocery stores internationally than does Lidl. So one could assume that maybe financially they are more capable of taking a hit on this front. Now, as a reminder, Kroger's stance is not that Lidl's products will make Kroger's good products appear maybe less so, but that they're using the likeness to potentially draw away traffic or have customers believe that there's some sort of connection between the new Lidl and the existing Kroger stores. And because Kroger has been in this country and been in multiple markets under multiple different brands for so long, there's apparently some worry here for Kroger, at least according to the lawsuit, that all of this brand equity that they've built up during that time may be quickly eroded because customers feel like there is some sort of connection between Kroger and Lidl. Now, if customers pay any attention to the news or any attention to the stories of this lawsuit, of course, it becomes very clear that they're not connected. But Leighton, the brand equity part of this and the brand awareness part of this is a huge portion of this lawsuit for Kroger and a huge portion of something they're going to have to prove to a judge or to an arbitration board.
Bowling through the details of this lawsuit, you're going to see that trademark infringement means a number of things. There's a lot of different things they look at, and there's 8 particular marks that we had noted on the last podcast. But the underlying theme here is, are the businesses like and are the products similar? And I think you're going to say yes to both of those. And I think if you're looking at the types of goods in question, both here are trying to extract the best value for their consumer, and they're always going to be private label. The intent of the defendant is to try to compete in the grocery sector. And if you're looking at the likelihood of the expansion of marked product lines, I think you're going to also check that box as well. You're seeing that, as you mentioned, Trent, 85% or over 85% of Lidl's product mix is private label. So I think right here you're seeing that two competitors are going at it. And I think, again, as I had mentioned on the last podcast, the only party that really wins are the lawyers on both sides of the equation. We keep it in the grocery sector with Jana Partners, the activist investor that gave Whole Foods some qualms. They've now exited their position after the proposed merger between Whole Foods and Amazon. Amazon is looking to acquire Whole Foods, obviously making the media rounds over the last few weeks, talking about the implications of the deal and what it could do to the grocery industry overall. But we're looking at Jana Partners, as they were an activist investor here for some time within Whole Foods, really trying to make the company restructure themselves in a number of ways. One of the ways recently that they've done so is having no co-CEO position with John Mackey. John Mackey, now the only CEO at Whole Foods, and they've also rearranged some of their board seats. You saw some board members leave, and you also see some attempts to really refocus the supply chain and an openness to partnerships and a potential buyout deal. Strategic partnerships have been talked about for some time regarding this Whole Foods story, but before the massively covered $13.4 billion Amazon deal closes, Jana is looking to take their profits and run. We see shares have been bouncing on either side of the $42 a share mark since news of the deal broke, giving Whole Foods the appropriate $13 to $14 billion valuation that is sure to close after all the regulatory oversight takes place later on this summer. But you look at how much they owned, rumors pegged the stake right around 9%. It turns out those rumors were correct. On Wednesday, Jana Partners said in a filing with the SEC that it is exiting its position of 26 million shares, or about 8.2% in the grocery chain, making it a profit of a roughly $300 million. However, according to available information, they did actually start selling a few shares right after the deal was announced. So one could look at that as almost hedging there. The shares were bouncing between $41 and $43 a share. And it's interesting, this company, Trent, had actually taken shares of Whole Foods between $29 and a reported $32 a share. So they really are getting a hefty take. But the broader implications are, what happens when an activist investor really looks to be taking part in a corporation and touting their long-term vision while in the end they only take the short-term outlook?
We talk about this quite frequently, not only on this podcast, but also on the Food Focus, where we were talking about the similar type of deal that's going on right now with Buffalo Wild Wings. It seems like a lot of these activist investors only have short-term outlooks at hand. And ultimately, I think long-term for an industry like the retail industry or the food service industry, these type of things may not be good. And in this circumstance, you saw that Jana consistently advocated for exploration of alternatives going forward, what companies often term strategic alternatives, which is basically code word for selling off to a different company. In this circumstance, you have Whole Foods pending deal with Amazon. But as a whole, other than helping out Jana Partners' bottom line, and all credit to them, they did exactly what their investors would want them to do. They managed to massively profit off of their stake in Whole Foods, so they got the job done. But in terms of the retail landscape as a whole, this type of activist investing can't always be seen as a good thing. And we see the effects of this Whole Foods sale to Amazon, or at least the pending Whole Foods sale to Amazon, on all of the other grocery stocks in the marketplace. The point being is that when these activist investors take a very large portion of a company's shares, they kind of add volatility to the industry that wouldn't be there otherwise. And some people might term this disruption, certainly. That's the hot word in the marketplace. But overall, when you look at activist investors in the retail landscape, typically it adds to the volatility of the overall landscape. And as we see here, puts other stock prices at risk. So looking ahead for companies, I think it's incumbent upon them to kind of play down some of these activist investors. And there's only so much you can do once you get into a proxy war and that type of thing. But I think Whole Foods should be allowed to be maybe a little bit of a warning sign, because we don't know where Whole Foods stock might have ended up 2, 3, 4 years from now. We don't know where they'd end up without Amazon's interference. But what we do know is there are plenty of shareholders out there that bought in at the $45 or $50 mark, and they feel a little bit jilted now because a larger investment firm came in, bought up a ton of shares, and then exited their stake in the company after the company agreed to sell to a different company at a premium over the share price that large investment firm bought it for. Now, I know this happens across multiple different layers of the economy, across multiple different stocks. It happens in the energy sector. It happens in the real estate sector. It happens in the healthcare sector. It happens all over the place. But when you tinker with retail settings, oftentimes you add not only volatility to the stock market, but you also add volatility to a number of different things. even on down to employment at the ground level. And that's something that Whole Foods was very clear about. Actually, when they were talking about investors buying into Whole Foods at certain points in time, and John Mackey, Layton, had mentioned this in the past, saying that basically, if you didn't condone Whole Foods' message, there was no point to investing in them. In this circumstance, the company, Whole Foods, agrees to sell off to Amazon, and I think, honestly, these two companies couldn't be farther apart in terms of the way they regard some of their treatment of employees and that type of thing, and the whole wage ordeal as well.
Yeah, and if you look at Whole Foods as a company overall and its storied history, you see that they've often preached the way of giving back to their local communities as a corporation, not being such an overbearing corporation like a Walmart is often viewed, coming into some place and sort of disrupting the smaller businesses. Rather, John Mackey had often been an advocate for giving back to local charities and really giving the workers there at each individual Whole Foods location an above average wage and above average health benefits as well in the common workplace. If you look and compare and contrast these benefits, you can see that the workers generally were more happy at these Whole Foods locations. And so now you see with the impending sale to Amazon, a lot of volatility, a lot of worrisome behavior in these local stores, a lot of worries already happening from downsizing the amount of hours that people are working and downsizing the staffing levels at some of these locations. And this is something that the company has talked about. I have to applaud them at being transparent over the past few earnings calls. John Mackey has said that they do need to adjust their ways, but I think the heart of Whole Foods is a company that gives back and really cares about their stances when it comes to social responsibility or corporate social responsibility. And these important tenets are something they've often addressed. And John Mackey had stated before through previous investor days that if you're a potential shareholder of the company that really doesn't like these tenets, doesn't like the fact that they give back to these local charities, it is your right to not invest in the corporation. He said he's fine with that. And as an example, they actually have a Vanguard Social Index Fund, which is made up of over 400 companies that the management said are screened for social, human rights, and environmental criteria. So for every investor that is not on board with giving back to local charities and giving back to these communities, there's going to be those investors that are okay with that. And in fact, are championing the idea that they should invest in companies that are pro-corporate social responsibility. So after having cut hours already and reduced those staffing levels, many stakeholders are worried that inevitably more cuts are going to be coming in the company after the closing of the Amazon acquisition. I'm curious to see how all the stakeholders do react to the impending changes. Obviously, a lot of talk about what Amazon is going to do as far as home delivery. Obviously, Whole Foods already has several partnerships set up in certain markets where they do have that home delivery, but they're saying that things like that or things like automation at the register could mean reduced staffing levels and maybe less morale in the general workplace.
I think a lot of people, including us, could see this coming. After all, Jana Partner says on their website even that they invest both long and short in companies either undergoing or expected to undergo change. They wouldn't invest in Whole Foods or wouldn't have invested in Whole Foods if they didn't expect that they would be able to kind of pressure or at least steer Whole Foods a little bit further towards that change, which was basically almost cataclysmic on a stock level for the grocery industry. But I think one of the more interesting notes throughout this entire story, now that we know that Jana Partners is planning on selling their stake and we've got the SEC information about it, they don't have news releases about this on their website. They've got a number of other releases, but no release about this in particular. And you wonder if, again, that's a PR move so that they don't maybe draw attention to the fact that they're exiting their stake in Whole Foods after such a short time following the sale to Amazon. But again, this is kind of their MO. This is what they attempt to do with their larger investments. And this should be no surprise to anyone who saw this deal originate. Coming up after a message from Lightspeed Speakers Series, we'll have Leah McGrath. She is a retail corporate dietitian for Ingles Markets in the southeastern United States. That's right, we stay in the grocery industry for our interview. She will detail how important the position of a corporate dietitian is for grocers and what type of changes that dietitians have made in the grocery industry since the position was popularized.
Think back to when you started your business. You had a dream. You had boundless passion. You wanted to create something different. There was a problem, and you were going to solve it. Being an independent retailer is rewarding, but challenging, and there's a lot more to it than you ever imagined. Well, Lightspeed is here to help. With 45,000 customers around the world, we've helped countless entrepreneurs nail the business side of retail so they can spend time doing what they're passionate about. Join us for a six-week speaker series featuring a curated panel of experts that will answer some of retail's toughest questions and give you the edge you need to stay competitive. You have a passion, and we have a passion for technology inspired by you. Visit lightspeedhq.com/speaker-series to learn more.
Increasingly, supermarkets and grocery stores are looking to in-house nutrition and dietitian experts to educate their customer base. As we saw growth of this trend, we thought it pertinent to invite a dietitian with one of the pioneering grocers in this area to see what the job entails and why it is important for grocers to have nutritionists and dietitians on staff. Leah McGrath is the corporate dietitian for Ingles Markets, a company with over 200 locations in six states. Leah was hired by Ingles in 2000, far before most grocers had a dietitian on staff. As an Ingles representative, she's written for WNC Parent Magazine, Smoky Mountain News, and the Asheville Citizen Times. She has a blog at InglesInfoAisle.com, is a regular guest on WSPA-TV in South Carolina, and has a weekly radio program on WWNC 570 AM, also in Asheville. Leah, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us today on the podcast.
Well, thanks to you, Trent, for asking me to be on. I appreciate it.
First of all, could you walk us or our listeners through a typical day, maybe a typical week for a dietitian at Ingles?
Wow, I wish there was a typical day or week, Trent, because it really sort of depends on what I'm doing and where I'm going. And I think that's one of the parts about my job that I like the most. I could be traveling to one of our stores in South Carolina, Tennessee, Georgia, or North Carolina. I could be visiting a farmer or a food entrepreneur or spending the day writing or preparing to do TV or working on a presentation or giving a presentation. So there aren't really too many typical days, but that's the great part of my job.
So you've got a lot of different things, obviously, on your plate, and I'm guessing these roles have all developed over the last several years since you got on with Ingles in 2000. How has your role specifically changed since you were hired?
Well, I do a lot more with media and specifically with social media, of course, because that really didn't even become a thing until, you know, maybe 6 or 7 years ago. So, yes, you're absolutely right. The job has really changed quite a bit. And my way of interacting with people has really changed from, you know, there was a time when I first started where I actually got letters in the mail with questions. And I don't even remember the last time I got a letter in the mail. And now all of my communication is either by phone calls or increasingly, of course, by email or by tweets. So that's really, really changed the landscape. And then just being involved with television and having a radio program has really changed. I've probably been doing that for maybe the past 8 or 9 years. So yeah, just a different, larger role, I guess.
We mentioned social media. You're very active on social media. You got a number of people, not only that you follow, but followers. You have a lot of interactivity there. About how much of your day is spent maybe responding to things or planning things out for social media?
You know, I try and do that sort of in different blocks of time. So usually maybe first thing in the morning, and then, you know, I might check it at different points during the day. And I do schedule some things on Facebook, so that makes it a little bit easier. But I would say probably at least 2 or 3 hours per day is on social media, because I also run the social media pages for Ingles.
Wow. So there's a lot of time during the course of a week or a month cumulatively that you're on social media. I know you're very active in terms of not only your role at Ingles, but also in terms of, you know, speaking and talking to other dietitians as a whole.
And we were talking before we came on this interview about the fact that there were maybe a couple dozen total dietitians for supermarkets in the country when you were hired in 2000. And now it seems like everyone does have a dietitian on staff. What's one of the reasons why you feel like this has changed so much and this has become a more popular thing to do in the grocery industry?
You know, you're very familiar with the retail landscape, Trent. So I think some of that had to do with competition. You know, if one supermarket chain saw another supermarket chain using it effectively, then it became something that they would adopt as well. And one of the biggest players in this space of kind of pushing more retail dietitians into the market would be Hy-Vee. And of course, they're a Midwestern supermarket chain, and they started probably about about 7 or 8 years ago, bringing dietitians into every store. And so they were really a role model in that area. And, you know, previously it had been more a corporate dietitian, the kind of role that I have. And then with players like Hy-Vee bringing dietitians into every store, they sort of set the bar to do that for other retailers.
And when we talk about some of these initiatives that Hy-Vee rolled out, what are some initiatives that you're particularly proud of that Ingles has put into place under your watch over the last 17 years?
I started probably not long after I first started. I started developing relationships with local hospitals and health departments to bring them into our stores and have the opportunity for customers and associates to talk with nurses and care providers in our stores. And we did things like blood pressure checks and blood sugar checks, blood glucose checks. And those relationships, many of those relationships have continued on for over a decade, well over a decade. And so that's one initiative I really worked on, trying to develop those community relationships. And then probably about 5 or 6 years ago, I started doing what we call Taste of Local events, where when I started to really see our customers asking for more local products, not only local produce, but local value-added products like jams and jellies and breads and meats, I started working on these events called Taste of Local, and they have become huge events in our stores about once a month, and where we bring in anywhere from 25 to over 30 local farmers and food entrepreneurs into our stores. It's kind of like an indoor farmer's market. And they're people that supply Ingles, and they are just a way for our customers to interact with these local farmers and food entrepreneurs. And it really shows our commitment to helping out local farmers and food entrepreneurs and supporting the local community.
I think one of the trends certainly in grocery that we're seeing is people are demanding more and more local produce, natural products, organic products, that type of thing. What are some other consumer trends that you've noticed, at least from a dietary or from a nutrition standpoint, over the last decade or so?
Well, of course, we went through the gluten-free, wouldn't really call it a fad, but probably back about 12 years ago, I started becoming really involved with a lot of our regional gluten-free and celiac support groups, and saw that there was a big need for better labeling, shelf-edge labeling for gluten-free products. And that predated the FDA's gluten-free labeling, voluntary gluten-free labeling on products. And we started doing, as a supermarket and for me as a dietitian, we started doing a lot of events and helping these local and regional support groups have gluten-free events. And we really sort of stood out in our region for having a wide range and a huge number of gluten-free products for the gluten-sensitive and celiac community. And that was a big advantage. And I think that then when we came into this sort of gluten-free fad situation where a lot of people were doing gluten-free as more of a fad diet, we already had those products in our stores and they were already labeled. So that was something that we really recognized early on, became a part of. But in terms of other products, in addition to local and gluten-free, I would definitely say organic. Ingles has always been a leader in organic products, USDA organic products, and we have thousands of organic items all over the store. And that's been a big interest for the Ingles family. They wanted to make sure that our supermarkets we're able to offer a wide variety of products, including organic products for our shoppers, long before it really was sort of a mainstream thing for supermarkets.
Leah McGrath is our guest on this week's podcast. She's the corporate dietitian for Ingles Markets. We've talked about, you know, shelf-side labeling for gluten-free products. We've talked about organics. We've talked about bringing farmers and food entrepreneurs into the stores. All of these things are probably things that you wouldn't have seen 30 or 40 years ago. Do you feel like the way in which people, and particularly Ingles customers, are looking at food has changed in the last 10 to 20 years?
Oh, definitely, Trent, without a doubt. I think we're definitely in a more affluent time where more of our customers have more discretionary income to spend on food items. And, you know, as a nation, we spend the least amount of our disposable income on food than almost any other developed nation in the world, I believe. So, you know, people are now looking for more international items, more exotic flavors. So I think it is a real challenging time to be in the supermarket space because you have to be pretty nimble and you have to offer your customers a wide variety of products, especially when you are in areas that are more metropolitan. People really expect that. They expect to be able to have a lot of choices and a lot of options.
One of the things that I've noticed on your blog, too, is kind of preaching moderation, not only in terms of consumption, but also in terms of viewpoints. You had a recent blog, for example, talking about sugar and how maybe sugar isn't as harmful or dangerous or as addictive as the headlines would have you believe. We deal with the same thing in retail, talking about how Amazon's killing everyone off and that type of thing.
Right.
All these hyperbolic statements out there. Do you feel like, you know, some of the blogs and some of the kind of the clickbait headlines that are out there maybe unduly shape the way people look at food?
Oh, without a doubt. And I think that, you know, in talking to our buyers at Ingles, and sometimes they just shake their heads and they say, you know, we don't remember a time like this where people were so afraid of food. And I think definitely that level of fear has been ratcheted up because of things like social media, because of things like bloggers who may not have the education or experience and who may be so removed from agriculture and farming and not understand some of the techniques and the technology that's used. And so people become very fearful of what's in their food, how food's being prepared, or how animals are being cared for. I feel like as a dietitian, and I know I hear some of this from our buyers as well, we spend a lot more time trying to educate and even calm people down about food than ever before.
You mentioned working directly with the buyers, working directly with a number of suppliers. What are some things that, you know, going forward next 2 to 4 years or so, what are some things that you think will either need to be changed in grocery stores in terms of how food is merchandised and presented, or from a dietary perspective, what are some things that you'd like to see changed just across the board, not necessarily with Ingles specifically?
Wow. You know, I think that the easier we can make it for people to access and grab the ingredients and like a composed meal, the better we'll be positioned to compete against meal delivery and, you know, ordering online. So I think that that's going to be a big challenge moving forward. How do we compete with those types of things? The atmosphere in the stores, is it inviting? Is it maybe even an element of fun and pleasure in the stores to make people want to come into the supermarket and spend time there and not avoid going there because it's a hassle or it's stressful or it's confusing? So, you know, I think it's going to be, the next few years are going to be very telling and very interesting for the whole supermarket landscape.
I want to close on this, and this is a little bit of a pivot from what we've been talking about in terms of the future from food, how perspectives on food have changed. You're obviously out in the public eye a lot. You respond to people a lot on social media. You're very visible, in effect. What is, looking back on your time at Ingles, maybe the most impactful interaction you've had with a customer that said, you know, I didn't used to think about food this way, and now I think about it maybe a different way, or has just maybe attributed you or Ingles to some sort of life change that they've been able to make?
Gosh, you know, I've been very fortunate, Trent, to have a lot of moments like that where people have come up to me and said, you know, I read your article and thank you for writing that, or I heard that interview and thank you for saying that. You know, there have probably been a couple, if I could just say two of them. One of them was January is, as we all know, January is typically a time when everybody starts their brand new diet and, you know, everybody wants to lose weight and reform their new year. And I decided one year to write an article about people who need to gain weight because, you know, there are people who are suffering from different illnesses or diseases or going through cancer treatment. And I wrote about some of the challenges that people meet who face having to gain weight. And I had a woman come up to me and she was practically crying. And she said, you know, everybody was always focused on losing weight, but, you know, I have been getting treatment for cancer. And I can't tell you how much it meant to me to see what you had written about how I could help me gain weight, what some tips were. And that was a really special moment for me because my mother actually suffered through cancer and later died. But, you know, just to keep in mind that when you're a supermarket dietitian, you have a huge customer base. So you have to really respect all of your customers. And then I think another time I was writing about genetic engineering and food labeling and not being afraid of our food. And a gentleman came up to me and who had returned from a missionary trip in Africa and said how much he appreciated reading what I had written and how people, if they ever traveled to a country like Africa, would realize how privileged and fortunate we are in the United States to have so many choices and not be constantly worried about where our next meal is coming from or going to bed hungry. Most of us don't have that problem. And certainly in Africa, it's much more of a threat or an issue than it is in the United States. But those are two special moments for me.
Those are great stories indeed. Thank you for sharing those with us. And Leah, thank you for coming on the Retail Focus podcast.
Thanks so much, Trent. I appreciate you.
We thank Leah for her time and for appearing on the Retail Focus podcast, and certainly looking forward to some of the other initiatives she's got in the pipeline for Ingles, and also we'll be keeping an eye on movements surrounding retail dietitians as a whole in the United States. Well, we talked on Food Focus this week about a recall in the hot dog industry, and we shift gears. We're still talking about a recall, but this time in the fashion industry. Ascena Retail, oh, poor Ascena Retail. It seems like they can do nothing right at this time. And on this occasion, it's teen mall staple Justice that Ascena Retail owns that's in the news after a notice is released about asbestos being in certain cosmetic items. And I think the number one question people have here, Leighton, is how on earth did asbestos get into cosmetic items? No one seems to know the answer to this question, but it was kind of a localized story that broke big in the retail world over the last few days.
Caught us off guard, especially since the company said that it hasn't really stemmed where the asbestos is coming from, but they are undergoing an internal investigation, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But the report, as you mentioned, is interesting because it stems from a very small news affiliate, WTVD, based out of Durham, North Carolina, and the product they reported on was Just Shine Shimmer Powder from Justice Stores, and it tested positive for asbestos, a fiber compound that is poisonous to humans when ingested. And the magazine Good Housekeeping did note and did some reporting that they found that this product is actually being sold throughout the country in many of Justice's locations. So this isn't just one location. This isn't isolated to just one market. It's actually something that's sold throughout. But this product has been taken off the shelves now through a report from Justice and Justice's management. WTVD used the Scientific Analytical Institute in Greensboro, specifically that of Sean Fitzgerald, their director of research and analytical services. Within the makeup, their asbestos fiber traces were traced back to the talc, so it did not exist in all the chemical compounds found within the makeup itself. You're seeing that this really isn't that common. However, it is tested for by the FDA and other government agencies from time to time. Cosmetics do seem to be at the forefront of a lot of controversy. We're seeing that ingredients are often looked at when it comes to the origination, where they're coming from, such as the use of animal byproducts. But oftentimes, due to animal testing protocols in other countries that companies that operate here in the U.S. have, many companies are known to do certain tests abroad, then distribute here domestically, a lot receiving criticism for that. And the FDA, like I said, does frequently test for asbestos on cosmetics, even with talc, but it is unclear how they missed this one, however.
So let's talk about some of the health issues. I think many of us are probably familiar with the idea that asbestos isn't a good thing. Of course, asbestos remediation and asbestos removal takes place in buildings still all throughout the country to try and rid the buildings of asbestos. But asbestos specifically refers to a group of several types of natural minerals. Asbestos minerals are small, durable fibers, and they're usually resistant to heat, fire, and many chemicals, thus the reason they were used in buildings during the better portion of the last century. However, any exposure to this group of minerals can lead to pleural mesothelioma and other diseases such as lung cancer or asbestosis, in fact. One of the things that Fitzgerald told WTVD after testing this product in his labs is basically that fibers, by putting them on your face in this way, they can get into your zone of breathing, and when you inhale, especially after you've just put on the product or while you're putting on the product, these fibers can get into the lung and can go to the bottom of the lung, and that's where you end up having the likelihood of some disease forming, apparently, is in the bottom of the lung. And Fitzgerald advocated the fact that children, of all people, shouldn't be allowed to breathe it, and of course, this is who this product is targeting. He says, and I quote, "If a 10-year-old inhaled this fiber today, when he or she is 50 years old, it's still there." So it's kind of a bioaccumulative effect here with asbestos. And you might be asking, well, since asbestos is a mineral, talc is a mineral, might those come into contact with one another? And in fact, there was a previous lawsuit that Teen Vogue pointed to regarding talc that cost Johnson & Johnson hundreds of millions of dollars, but not based off of presence of asbestos in this case, but rather the health effects and the link to cancer from talc itself. Lesson being here that the affected products need to be taken off the store shelves immediately, and the root cause needs to be found as soon as possible, lest justice suffer this financial hit, and of course, lest they put anyone else in potential danger. When you look up asbestos health effects, obviously you're going to get a slew of WebMD and Google type results, but it appears as though upon researching asbestos a little bit further, it shouldn't come into contact with talc, which is another mineral in a natural state. So that, again, leaves the very pertinent question that has yet to be answered. How did the asbestos get into the product? And I think, Leighton, it was interesting how Justice actually responded to this after WTVD reached out.
Yeah, with a corporate statement from Justice, they're saying that they are committed to the safety and integrity of their products. And upon receiving the inquiry from WTVD, they began immediately undergoing an independent investigation. And they said they can't speculate regarding the matter until they have more information. But out of the abundance of caution, they stopped the sale of the product and they're going to be continuing the investigation. So I'm curious to see where the company goes from here. Again, it behooves the company to react quickly in this because, again, if you take time, that is more potential litigation that could happen down the line. Obviously, a very expensive thing. And Ascena Retail, which is the parent company of Maurice's, Lane Bryant, Catherine's, and Ann Incorporated, has already been seeing some financial trouble. So to add this to that, to add this as a potential liability on their balance sheet would not be a healthy thing to do. But I am curious to see where this goes, and we'll be sure to keep our listeners posted on the findings as they complete their independent investigation. And a story that is, again, something that could be in an episode of the Food Focus podcast, Meijer is adding home delivery of liquor, beer, and wine to their delivery services in Michigan. This comes as part of their delivery services through the company Shipt, who has delivery agreements through a number of different grocers. And Shipt memberships run around $99 a year, around $14 per month if you want to do a monthly membership. Orders under $35 have a $7 delivery fee, so really incentivizes customers to buy more through these local grocers. The home delivery service launched in Detroit metro area about a year ago, and has since expanded dramatically. Up to this point, the delivery service has been basically for food and essentials with no alcohol in the equation. So this is going to be a new service for the grocer. And you see that home delivery isn't limited to Michigan either, where you see in Michigan, about one half of Meijer's locations exist. We see other shipped markets include Wisconsin, Chicago, Indiana, Ohio, and Northern Kentucky. And that's kind of interesting because if you look at the history of Shipt, you see that the company launched in the summer of 2014 in Alabama, of all places, Birmingham, Alabama, but it has expanded rapidly and now over 55 cities. And the company says they're actually working with more and more vendors every day. And their ongoing mission is actually to improve the quality of life by improving the network between members, shoppers, and communities with convenience and freedom. And you see a lot of other competing companies trying to do this. But for Meijer's part, a privately held company that is always looking to expand with over 225 locations is looking to have that network bring in customer loyalty, brand loyalty. And you see, not just in the Michigan area, but with additional locations in Indiana, Kentucky, Ohio, and the aforementioned Wisconsin. But overall, you see that this company is actually one of the largest U.S. companies, and this is a company trying to take advantage of the ongoing trend of having things shipped to your homes, so why not alcohol too?
The obvious question for a listener might be how this is to be executed from a logistics standpoint for both Meijer and Shipt. Well, it will first require Shipt drivers handling those orders to be over 21, since they are working to fulfill the orders and they're also transporting the alcohol here. So there's no way you could have anyone under 21 doing that same thing. But the nice thing is for Shipt, their system allows things to be vetted on the back end. So as customers submit orders to Shipt for, say, a Meijer store, only 21 or older drivers will see jobs involving liquor or some sort of a liquor order. Now, on the customer end, they're required to provide valid identification to place a liquor order. And this goes above and beyond just putting the burden on the Shipt fulfillment driver as well, since many of Shipt's employees are independent contractors. This would be hairy from a legal standpoint. So customers are, according to Shipt's user policy, required to begin an ID process that starts even before the order is processed. Usually this includes working with a Shipt partner, in this case Meijer, to ID the shopper and make sure that their age is verified and over 21. In this way, they are able to tie in an actual brick and mortar retailer. They can have someone check and okay the identification. Now, they also go through in their terms of use, does Shipt, and claim that they are not responsible for any alcohol delivery. They're not responsible for any wrongdoing that may stem from the alcohol delivery. And they're also not responsible if, say, a 21-year-old purchases alcohol delivery from Shipt and then turns around and gives that to a minor. So they try to cover themselves on a legal standpoint, because anytime you enter the alcohol fray, there are some legalities to be taken care of there. And one of the things that Shipt mentions in their terms of use, their new terms of use after this Meijer rollout, is that they're not only not able to be held liable for any of these liquor purchases by their customers, but also they say in big, bold typeface that they are not a liquor seller and they make no claims as to being a seller of liquor, making sure that they don't get in trouble from a license perspective in these individual states. Now, this may or may not expand depending on rules in the states. Right now in Michigan, these rules do restrict in terms of day parts when you can deliver the alcohol. These rules are even more restrictive when you look at other Meijer markets, including Wisconsin, where in many areas in Wisconsin, you can't sell liquor after as early as 8 or 9 p.m. And of course, laws are different in Chicago. And Leighton mentioned the Northern Kentucky areas with Louisville and Lexington and Cincinnati, all of that. Meijer will have to get things worked out on a state-by-state basis before they can expand it. Now, Shipt does offer deliveries to most Meijer markets, but as for Meijer, the burden now will be on them to try and work through the legalities of doing this in other states before people outside the state of Michigan can take advantage of this delivery service.
Overall, though, I think it is interesting that Meijer has really taken the bull by the horns in terms of a third-party delivery service. Their partnership with Shipt is very strong, considering that Meijer puts perhaps more eggs in their appearance basket in terms of brick and mortar than maybe any other supersized retailer that's that large. Again, the stores, they look for a spotless store appearance. They order their produce in such a specific and precise fashion as to appear appealing to the shopper. And yet now they are putting a lot of their resources towards these delivery programs, these third-party delivery programs. And I think that's promising for Meijer's future. One other quick note on Meijer, that Bridge Street Market that we spoke with Chandra Martinez about a few weeks ago. She was the reporter for MLive.com regarding their new smaller footprint concept. Turns out that that's going to have a solar wall and a massive solar battery as well. So they're trying to build a more energy-focused store. It kind of ties into an earlier interview, in fact, we had with Aaron Moulton of Treehouse and trying to design their store down in Dallas. So Meijer's got their hands on a lot of interesting things right now.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, as we do every week, we conclude our show on Retail Focus by giving you a story that we're looking ahead to over the next week or the next month. There's only one this week, and it comes via online apparel retailer Everlane, as Everlane's announced their first brick-and-mortar location in San Francisco. Now, they've done other pop-up stores in the past, mostly in large markets, in particular New York City. Everlane has been around since 2010, and they are an e-commerce fashion retailer that is at the forefront of a lot of these online e-commerce fashion movements. Their site talks much about transparency, about the materials used to make the clothes, but more importantly, I think for Everlane, their price points are lower. So this is one of those rare times where we see an e-commerce fashion retailer with lower price points. Most of their shirts, for example, are under $50. Open their first brick and mortar location. We've obviously seen more premium level e-commerce retailers do the same thing. We talk about Bonobos's fitting shops and that type of thing. So Everlane really is a unique study on this. And we'll be watching this story very carefully to see how their first retail location does in San Francisco. And if they seek to open other retail locations, maybe in New York where they've tried those pop-up shops in the past, or maybe other locations along the West Coast in, say, Los Angeles or Seattle, other areas where their products are extraordinarily popular. But Everlane is a unique company. They have differentiators. And honestly, going ahead, we think that this could be a company that could kind of buck the whole series of closures in the brick and mortar fashion space. That'll do it for us on the Retail Focus podcast. For Layton, I'm Trent. A big thanks to our sponsors, Warby Parker and, of course, Lightspeed and their speaker series. Check out their website, lightspeedhq.com/speaker-series. It's a perfect solution for retailers, restaurateurs, and independent businesses. We'll be back with another food focus and another retail focus next week. Follow us as well on Twitter @RetailPodcast. If you like us, rate us certainly on iTunes and make sure you're subscribing there. Until next week, so long.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter @RetailPodcast.